Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello, and welcome to That's Life, Spectator Life's sideways look at the world today. I'm Benedict Spence.
And I'm Andy Shaw.
And on this podcast, we'll be opening up a bottle of wine together and poking fun at the words, people and ideas that have popped up in the news over the last few weeks. Now, for those of you who have stuck with us this far, first and foremost, we'd like to say thanks. We know this can't have been easy for you. But that's why we've decided to finesse our output, move away from the sort of the manly banter that we've been having up until this point. And so this week, we have elected to have a woman's touch. We've chosen a gal so strong and independent, she'll reach back through time to emasculate our previous guests with a pair of children's safety scissors to even up the gender ratio. I'm talking, of course, about the queen of talk radio, journalist and broadcaster Julia Hartley Brewer. Julia recently put Michael Gove through his paces on her show over the price of his petrol car ban. After avoiding giving her a straight answer, no less than 8 times, Michael promised to buy her a slap-up meal if he was proved right on the supposedly bargainous cost of electric vehicles. Nando's Victoria, you're on your way. But Julia, we think we can go one better than a slap-up meal here at That's Life. We can offer you glasses of wine, coffee, tea... Actually, no, we can't do any better than Nando's Victoria. I'm very sorry, but thanks for coming along anyway.
You're welcome.
So, what have you been up to? How are things?
What have I been up to? I've been just getting up at silly o'clock every morning to present a radio show, which you actually often come on.
And do
you're,
I?
You're very sprightly.
I am.
Of a morning. You bring your moustache and you sort of, you know, bound in the morning. You're looking like an extra from Narcos. It's great.
You have other guests as well, though, don't you? It's not just me.
God knows we wouldn't have any listeners if it was just you.
No.
Or indeed just me.
Just you and me talking about moustaches. That is basically what the show is about, isn't
it? That's mostly what we do in our sports updates. But for some reason, that our sports update has just become talking about Benedict's moustache. But long story.
Now, Julia, you're known for your shy and retiring opinions.
Mostly.
And, you know, the format, we like to talk about what's been going on in the news recently. So I suppose I'd just like to ask, is there anything with your expert eye that's really leapt out in the last few weeks that, you know, has really captured the moment?
Well, captured the moment, I have to say, was that Friday morning at just before 10 o'clock, before I came off air, actually, was when Philip Schofield of This Morning decided to come out, despite being married for 27 years with 2 adult children. Such a shock, I think, mainly because Philip Schofield is one of those people, like Anton Deck, who everyone knows. And at least with Philip, you know which one he is, on the left or the right. It's just him. But I suppose now it feels that someone who, like, if you've ever been on maternity leave, if you've ever pulled a sickie, you definitely spent a lot of time in your life with Philip Schofield. He's been presenting This Morning for many, many years, and he does an awful lot of shows. He is one of these people that's just sort of, you know, just part of British, you know, pop culture life. And the news that apparently we didn't know him at all, and it turns out he's someone completely different from the person we knew, because it turns out that he is actually gay, perhaps he's different from the person he knew, we don't know, I think was quite a big moment. I've met lots of people who say, why are people talking about this? Well, the fact that he is still big news, the fact that it is still front page of tabloid newspapers, says that actually this is quite a big deal. But what I find interesting is someone who's very, very much in favour of people living their best life.
Too right.
I'm really, really in favour. I think it's absolutely awful that anyone who is gay or bi doesn't feel that they can come out and live the life they want to lead. So I don't have any issues with that whatsoever. I'm welcoming it. But I was absolutely stunned by the next couple of days after that revelation, how many married women volunteered to me that they were very unhappy with this celebrating and this praising of the bravery, stunning and brave, behaviour of Philip Schofield. Now, everyone's reaction was how wonderful it was. And every single married woman I knew said, what about his wife? Yes, she's standing by him. But everyone's wife's going, yep. Hold on a minute.
Fair point.
Let's talk about the wife here. Because if he had said, and it's not known yet whether he's been in relationships with men or not while he's been married, certainly not publicly known yet, but if it is the case that, you know, he has had relationships or is going to end up having relationships with men, if that was him with a another woman, we wouldn't be celebrating it. We would be castigating it. He would be, thrown to the wolves for leaving his loyal wife of 27 years. And yet, because he's gay, we're celebrating it. I do think there's a...
What's going on here?
There's a bit more nuance there for a lot of people.
But there's something funny going on, isn't it? There's a tweet I'm going to read out from Gareth Roberts, who used to write for Doctor Who, and used to write a lot for the BBC until he made some mistake in describing men as women and women as men or something.
He stated a biological fact and then he got...
Anyway, he was taken down for that. But he put a tweet out. Gareth, who is gay, he said, "I'm loving the idea that we homos have to be celebrated, like we're Christmas or something, greeted with champagne corks popping, bunting festooned all over the shop whenever we pop our little heads around the corner."
Like that idea. Lots of glitter. Everybody's dressed up very nicely.
For me, a lot of it is, it's like celebrating, we've now got a woman Met Commissioner, a woman Home Secretary, a woman this, a woman that. You say, oh, for goodness sake, we've had two female Prime Ministers. Can we please move on from this? I completely understand. If this was done 20, 30 years ago, if this someone who... had been forced to live a lie, then that's very different. But I do think in the entertainment business, there's one business you can come out in and survive, and come out in literally and survive, this would be it. But of course, there are lots of stories all over the internet which haven't been published yet.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty well sourced, a lot of them,
mm-hmm.
Suggesting all is not quite as, shall we say, wholesome as perhaps ITV press office might like. I don't know the veracity of any of it. And I've done this morning many times. I used to be on the show twice a week. I'm a very big fan of Philip Schofield. He's an amazingly clever, funny, brilliant presenter. I think he's absolutely superb. But I just do think the reaction has been quite strange.
I think it is. I think it's really odd. It's one of those moments where you're not quite sure what's really going on. And I'm not sure why, in our society, which is incredibly not just tolerant, but actually just really accepting.
I don't like the word tolerant. People,
no, I don't either. But it's accepting.
So we're putting up with it. I'm putting up with people being gay. I just don't care.
It's become an unimportant issue. It's the least interesting
for a lot of people. I think younger generations. I say younger generations. I'm 51, but my generation downwards. I can definitely know that people in their 70s who would not think of themselves as bigot in any way, but would still use language that I would be uncomfortable with, and I think most of us in this room would be.
Yeah, but I think most people are well-meaning, and actually, even people who may be uncomfortable with it personally have just adapted to it and accepted it, and sort of moved on.
But the fact that it is such big news, front page of papers, tabloid newspapers,
but actively celebrating—that's the odd thing. I mean, why? If you find a woman's anatomy sexually attractive, right? That's, uncommented upon. But if you actually prefer rubbing up against another man, then that is actively celebrated.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's been described to me in intimate detail, which is probably inappropriate to go on to on this podcast. But that's actively celebrated. That's something that you do get the bunting out and spray it, have the rainbow.
Is this
rainbow
just
cork,
as we classically have in sort of woke politics and woke culture these days, where you instead of going from, you go all the way from the bad extreme of isn't that awful, horrible words being used about men and women who are gay, and people being, not in my lifetime, people being thrown in prison simply for loving someone of the wrong gender. We're going from that extreme, and now we're at the other extreme, which is, it's wonderful to be gay and so much better than being straight and something to be celebrated over and above being straight. And really the reaction should be, okay. Well, as long as you guys are okay and your wife's okay with it, which I'm guessing she probably isn't, even though she's saying she is, because I don't know any woman who would be okay with her husband saying, actually, it turns out I'm not such a fan of women sexually as I am of men. I think it should be, in an ideal world, no one's business.
Absolutely.
This is simply a personal...
It's a very intimate and personal
tragedy
thing
for the Schofield family.
And it's a very intimate and personal thing to do with your relationships and your relationships with your family and your friends and your work colleagues and what have you. And it should be anyone's decision to... to say what they want and to live their life as they want to.
And to be as open as they want to be.
Absolutely. And it's not really a matter of public concern. I have thought that actually Philip Schofield looks slightly embarrassed about the level of response.
Yes.
As sort of Holly Willoughby was sort of nuzzling him into her breast.
And as we've discovered, like he's not such a fan of that.
Well, in a motherly way, Benedict. In a motherly way, he was nuzzling her. But it just looked, it all sort of almost infantilised him. he's sort of standing there smiling slightly awkwardly, I think, as this thing is really celebrated.
But that was where the celebration it's much more complex. Somehow no longer being a victim of, you know, heterosexual norms and then being celebrated for breaking free like a butterfly into, yeah, you know, into his new gay
breaking
life.
Breaking the norms. Maybe that's the thing.
And again, at the same time, every married woman I know volunteered to me, what about his wife?
Yes.
It must be said, I'm very glad you didn't go down the rabbit hole of the unsourced internet stories, because I thought we could have had two firsts that we didn't necessarily want. One, actually breaking a story. The second, being sued into oblivion straight away afterwards. Andy, has anything really leapt out to you in the last month?
Well, I think the moment, really, recently was the Horrible Histories video that Nish Kumar put out, which has been much commented on, but...
Just for some context, this was a Horrible Histories video on the BBC. It's aimed at children, isn't it?
It is, and it's a fantastic little series that takes a very humorous look at different aspects in history to make them accessible to kids, and so kids, you know, understand a little bit about historical events and historical people. It's a great little series. It was put out on around the time that we left the European Union. And
it was on the day, wasn't it?
I think it was. In fact, it was even introduced as the Brexit special. And it was really, really odd, because it did two things. One is it seemed to celebrate everything European and imply that everything in the UK that is good, worthy and useful has come from Europe.
Well, it wasn't that. It was saying
it was empire,
that all
wasn't
these
it?
Ideas that you, all these things that you think of as British, which apparently include tea, sugar, and cotton, none of which I don't think anyone who's ever even gone to school for a day thought were British, were from the empire, and therefore what our idea of what is British isn't British. But that wasn't anyone's idea of what is British, which is what was really bizarre about it. It was just so ridiculously ill-informed.
It's almost like and Nish Kumar is a really good example of this, where a straw man is held up. You know, people think this and therefore will go and attack it.
Yeah.
The bizarre thing is no one actually thinks this, so it becomes entirely, you know, entirely
drinking
false.
Tea, but I don't think anyone, I mean, whenever I'm driving, you know, around the country, I mean, I'm always passing those many tea plantations. I mean, what planet?
Utterly mad.
But again, it was this gratuitous opportunity to just have a dig at sort of little Englanders and the idea, you know, again, we're all Brexiters, I mean, we're all racist and ignorant and harking back to a golden age. And it was just so gratuitous. And I'm really glad he got the backlash he deserved for that.
The other thing is that he looked at everything from the point of a consumer, not a producer, which is a very sort of petty bourgeois way of looking at the world, is how we consume everything. So all the things that we invented and produced, like the steam engine, the thermos flask, the invention of the spoked wheel and the bicycle, you know, cement, mass production stainless steel, Tim Berners-Lee inventing the internet, and the Industrial Revolution is actually what we produce and what we've invented, not what we've consumed. So it's a very petty way of looking at life, is, well, let's look on the table of what we got at our dinner party. Where did that come from? Oh, that came from France, and this came from Italy, and this came from over here, rather than British people as producers and inventors, which is actually the most interesting thing about it.
It's all part of this very negative view that some, I would say, Remainiacs or Ramoners, but not Remain voters. Remain voters have perfectly good reasons to vote Remain, but it's all part of that ongoing idea.
The militant wing.
The militant wing, who have this incredibly negative view of not only the British people, but of pretty much everything in Britain and everything Britain stands for. Britain's history, Britain's every single thing they demean. And they have such a dim view of not only our history, our current culture, but also our future, which I think it must be so depressing to be one of these people. I'm an optimist. I'm always a glass half full person, and you know, history has borne me out. The world is so much of a better place this year than last year, than the year before, than 10 years ago, than 100 years ago, and it will continue to be so, and so is our country. And I don't understand why people have such a negative view of what has been an incredible transformation of both our country and the world around us.
It's really odd, isn't it, how a number of people who think they're very, very liberal and open-minded and sort of, you know, sort of very progressive in their outlooks have actually become the sort of miserable old uncle that you have to bump into at the occasional family gathering, who just sits there moaning about how everything is. They've actually become those grumpy old people.
The same people that used to mutter about things being better in the good old days, but they've now more from being the sort of the imperialists to being a different sort of imperialist. Now, the cotton one was the one that always got me. Whenever I get dressed in the morning, it does make me feel very proud. This great British tradition of being clothed brings a tear to the eye and start humming Jerusalem to myself. Well, I also had a moment. It's less one moment, I suppose, but it is typified by one moment, and that is the Labour leadership contest, rather the deputy leadership contest, and the rise of one particular individual who we've touched upon before, and I dare say we will touch upon again, and that is Richard Bergen. But the moment that really stood out for
comedy me... Comedy genius.
Oh, yes, he is the gift that keeps on giving. And unlike Donald Trump, he is not too difficult to satirise. The thing that really stood out for me was the suggestion that perhaps military decisions and the use of our vast arsenal should be put to the Labour membership to vote on in the event that we might go to war with somebody. And I just... I mean, for a start, I think it was a very honest moment from Richard Bergen, him admitting that actually he's incapable of taking those sorts of decisions and saying, I can't do it, you guys might as well do it. But I just wanted to ask what you all thought about that as an idea, given that half of the Labour membership are the sort of people that sing From the River to the Sea about Israel, and you know, that raises all sorts of awkward questions about, well, what then happens to Israel? How would you feel about putting the nuclear codes into the hands of the Labour membership, Andy?
Well, I think it shows a really insular way of thinking. So he's not thinking about how do we turn the Labour Party into a party that can take government. He's thinking about how do we run the Labour Party. So when the vote happened on the Syrian bombing and also the Iraq war, that it's almost like that's what he's become obsessed with. Look, the Parliamentary Labour Party and the MPs wanted to vote for war, but the membership didn't want to. So how do we increase the power of the Labour members over the Labour MPs? So it's such an insular way of thinking entirely within the Labour Party. And then when you try and take that as a policy, I mean, it's utterly mad. You know, warfare is not, you know, lines of tanks facing each other and then you have to make a decision. It's cyber warfare. It's no. I don't even approve
of Parliament having a vote on war. I do think that's what we have an executive to do. I think it's absolutely absurd. But I mean, I think really, if we're going to do it, let's have a full-on referendum and see how that goes. we'll have months of campaigning.
52-48.
I mean, Richard Berg, as you say, the gift who keeps on giving, I think it is genuinely terrifying that people who are that stupid, that dishonest and that ignorant have got that they're not just employed as village idiots, and B, that they've managed to get themselves elected and have a say in anything that happens in our country. I genuinely think that is scary. If that's the best we can do, and there's some pretty poor MPs on all sides, but if that's the best Labour can do, and he's actually getting support from the Corbynistas, I mean, there are no words. That said, for comedy value, let's be honest, Rebecca Long Bailey and Richard Bergen as leader and deputy leader would be hilariously funny, except the fact that we still then will not have an alternative government in waiting to hold this current government to account, which we in a democracy desperately need. I mean, that's where the fun stops, isn't it? Is that actually these people are certifiably insane.
Yes. I can't wait for the two of them to be elected, because then us three are in trouble.
if they get a hold
of this podcast.
I'm going to be in the internment camps very early on.
So, as regular listeners to this podcast will know, Andy, being something of a linguist, is compiling a bullshit dictionary full of interesting terms that perhaps used to mean one thing, now mean another, or have entered common parlance and are sort of leading the agenda. So I was just going to ask, Julie, is there any particular word phrase that's really stood out for you?
Certainly in recent months, the word catastrophe is the standout word. We are constantly talking about it. You know, the global warming catastrophe, the Australian fires is a catastrophe, any flooding is a catastrophe, a storm. Every single thing that happens, whether it's something that happens in a vote in Parliament or anything, everything now is a catastrophe. The catastrophization of catastrophes is wearing me down. There comes a point when just, you know, getting up in the morning and, I don't know, it not being quite warm enough when you put your foot out of the duvet, that's going to be a catastrophe at this rate. We have lost all sense of meaning for this word. It's taken over from crisis. It's now a catastrophe. But I mean, the climate change catastrophe is the one that I really get bothered by. Because, you know, again, you don't have to be a denier. You don't have to be, you know, swivel-eyed. You don't have to be Donald Trump. It's all a Chinese conspiracy. But to say that we have an issue with a changing climate, whether or not it's caused by man or not, that perhaps we need to tackle and deal with, and we need to move to cleaner energy and less pollution, sustainable fuels. Yeah, absolutely. Let's have a conversation about it. But this use, you know, from Greta Thunberg onwards of the climate catastrophe, I just find it's a turn off, and B, I don't think normal people believe it. I think only the sort of the quasi-religion cultists, like in Extinction Rebellion, and the people who've signed up to that, I think they believe it because they obviously have something terribly missing in their lives. They're little empty bits in their soul where they need to find a new religion to hang on to. And they're, you know, doom mongers. Ordinary people going about their daily lives do not believe, and not because they're ignorant, but based on the science they've seen and evidence of their own eyes and ears, that there is a catastrophe approaching. And I think the overuse of that word and that as a policy sort of driver, I think is a real issue, because it does get to the point when no one's going to believe anything governments say anymore.
It does seem that they are using it instead of actually persuading people around a particular argument. So
they're
if it's a catastrophe
us.
And it's a total emergency, therefore we have to do this.
It justifies
there is absolutely no
force,
debate.
It justifies high taxation. It justifies taking things away from people, forcing things on people. I tell you what, it's one thing I couldn't care less about cars. You can take away my diesel car. You try taking away my thermostat for my gas central heating. I'm in sort of gun lobby nut territory of Texans out of my cold, dead hands. And they will be cold, dead hands, because I need my thermostat for my central heating.
That would be a catastrophe, wouldn't it, really,
Julia?
You wouldn't want bare arms in that scenario.
Boom, cha.
Exactly. Andy, do you like catastrophe as a word? Like catastrophes?
It is one of those English words that does actually sound like, you know, it emphasises its meaning. But the thing that worries me is that we genuinely are scaring people. So,
and children in particular.
And children in particular. So, you know, Julia, you sort of, you know, you got some sense of perspective, and you've got, you know, they're not going to take your boiler off you. And they're not going to take boilers off.
They're not going to take my... Do you know that is government? That's going to be government policy in a matter of years.
It is, and I genuinely don't think they know what they're doing. In the sense that the Gilets Jaunes in France, it was a 7 euro cent increase on the price of petrol.
And they backtracked on it very quickly.
But it was visible. It was a very visible, we're doing this for the climate. I think once they start genuinely, you know, all the second-hand value of the cars is going to go, you know, cars are going to get a lot more expensive.
Well, it's not just diesel cars, it's going to be petrol cars. I mean, 2035, when you mentioned, I was talking to Michael Gove about this, you know, what's it going to cost? The street furniture, I live in a flat. Where am I going to be charging my car?
Yeah.
I don't have off-road parking. Most people in lots of major cities don't. But also, you know, the hybrid cars, they're going to be no sale of those. But again, people don't want to buy any of these cars up to 2035 or buy them second-hand where they've got no resale value. And we know they're going to be pumping huge amounts of resources into sort of making us buy electric cars. But most people don't buy new cars. And the huge effects of things like the street furniture for charging, the cost of the extra electricity generation, and no one is talking about how much this will cost.
Well, you asked Michael Gove.
Yeah. Who's paying for it and how much will it cost? They don't have costings.
So what's he doing? I've got a real question about what is going on with Michael Gove. Genuinely. Because in 2017, I remember after the Brexit vote, he went very green. And what was he, head of DEFRA or something? I can't remember what it was now.
Yeah,
he buddied up to the WWF and Greenpeace and all the sort of green lobbyists and seemed to wrap himself in the green cloak. And I thought, OK, you know, it's a bit of a tactical thing to say, look, we need Brexit so we can actually manage our environment and bring in our own policies. And he was trying to sort of get the Greens on side for Brexit. But I don't think that's what's going on. I think he really believes this. I think he's been Greta'd.
Yes.
In a way, not just that he's Greta has influenced him, I think he wants to be like Greta.
No, but also there is a whole thing now.
Michael,
you're
Greta.
If you're worried about the environment, to the extent that you're saying it's a catastrophe and we need to do something, and it's always do something, that makes you a nice person. So if you're saying, let's look at the cost-benefit analysis of doing something, how much will we actually change, given, you know, the less than 1% contribution anything that we do will make, even get rid of all the cars, get rid of all the aeroplanes in the entire world, get rid of our gas central heaters, will make no difference whatsoever to any man-made global warming. I mean, that's the fact.
No, it won't.
Matter of fact. So why would we be doing that? But the fact that there's not even... You're a bad person for even saying, Who's going to pay for this and how much will it cost? The British taxpayers right now are not going to get a choice because every major political party, leaving aside the Brexit party that's gone dormant, but I have a funny feeling will revive on this issue, that every single major party and minor party is fully signed up to the hysteria and the catastrophisation of this problem, as opposed to a really sensible, nuanced conversation about what can we realistically do? I mean, yeah, let's get rid of the plastic bottles we use once. Absolutely. Let's stop sending all our recycling and our rubbish over to Malaysia and China to deal with. Absolutely. And let's have cleaner vehicles. I think no one sensible is against any of that. But it's a question of how quickly you do it, how you do it. Do you let the market do it? Do you let technological innovation push this, which inevitably it will? Or do you force people? And find people. And quite apart from the fact, you get rid of all those old fuel cars, you get rid of the diesels and the petrol tax, you're looking at £38 billion. The fourth biggest income stream for the government is coming from taxing those cars. Well, that's going to have to be replaced from somewhere.
So Michael Gove, trying to be popular is going to create a genuine catastrophe.
Well, the interesting thing is, even though everybody is signed up to this, the madness in one degree or less in terms of the political parties, if the Tories do bring this in, it will be they who get punished.
Even
they are insane if they think that the British public are going to let this fly.
This is going to be bigger than the Brexit backlash. Yes. And I don't think they realise how massive this is. Because Brexit was around, it was around sovereignty and democracy, but it was around people's role in public life and where power lies politically.
And it's about control.
And around control, but it's not a day-to-day life thing. Yeah. Whereas this is about your standard of living and your individual personal freedom. So the backlash against it, I just don't think they recognise what's
going to happen.
I think
you're right. I think it's interesting. It's going to spawn something of a cultural movement. I think it would go down quite well, something like, Deep South Texan gun nut. I can imagine a British gas man turning up to your door and saying, "Excuse me, madam, where's your boiler?" And you cocking a shotgun going, "It's back the way you came." So, Julia, to round this all off, because, of course, we are gossips and we like talking about people, has there been an individual who stood out for you over the last few weeks that has particularly caught your eye?
Yeah, absolutely. you can't ever stop him catching your eye because of the bright orange hue. But Trump, I mean, it's just got to be Trump. Yet again, another big takedown by the Democrats to oust this clearly massively unfit person for public office. He's unfit to be the local dog catcher, for goodness sake. And yet the Democrats have failed yet again. We've had so many fails by them in terms of tackling President Trump all the way from 2016 onwards. I have no doubt at all he's going to win in November this year. Just no doubt at all. We had not only the failed impeachment, they knew from the moment they started that he was going to be acquitted, and that they let him hold up that Washington Post front page with Trump acquitted. So he's boosted his popularity whilst being impeached by Congress, and they managed to bugger up their own Iowa caucus as well, and they still don't seem to have a clear outright front runner for the Democratic nomination. And I am absolutely amazed by how wrong they are getting this. But Trump, I'm afraid, is going to be the word of the year for the next 4 years.
Did you see the State of the Union address? It was amazing. I haven't seen State of the Union addresses before, but this one was utterly compelling. It was like opportunity knocks. Did you see it when he was saying, and now we have Charles McGee, the first black fighter pilot, he's 100 years old, and we are going to today promote him to Brigadier General. Big round of applause, standing ovation. And over here we have Jenny Davis from Philadelphia, who's been denied an opportunity scholarship from the Philadelphia state government. And today, here, we give her an opportunity scholarship. Big round of applause. It's almost, I expected like a clapometer to come. It was like a opportunity knocks, that's life. It was unbelievable.
It was, and it really summed up the moment was when Nancy Pelosi ripped up the speech afterwards, because it was incredibly petulant, but right now, if you're a Democrat, what can you do?
But that's
your game plan.
But isn't it interesting, though, is that she got so much grief for that, and I thought it was really tacky of her to do that. And it's this, again, this is when he is the president. I mean, you can have a hashtag not my president. He is, love, he is your president. But this is when, he is speaking as head of state, not as a Republican. He's head of state at that point, and that's the key difference, where, our prime minister is always political. Their president is the head of the country. And he has done more terrible things than ripping up a speech. probably before 7 a.m. most mornings of his entire life. And yet she gets all the grief for that. But that's because, you know, you're supposed to be better than that, Nancy Pelosi. We know he's bad. But I do just find it extraordinary that the Republicans can get themselves, you see, you know, Fox TV, get it out, absolutely, I mean, outraged that Nancy Pelosi has ripped up a script, but not that bothered about the fact that they've elected a man who grabs women by the genitals without permission. That,
you'd never catch Philip Schofield.
The racism, the sexism, the no, not a problem, not an issue, but ripping up a bit of paper, heinous crime.
No, I agree. I think it's... But it is just extraordinary times to be alive. I personally think we'll look back on this, much like people look back on the latter days of George W. Bush and just think,
how?
Oh, what on earth was that? How on earth did we survive all that time? But I do think we will get through it. I don't think he'll blow us all up with, you know, slip finger on the nuclear button. Julia, thank you so much for coming in. And I suppose this is now the opportunity to plug your show. Not that anybody who listens to this podcast doesn't listen to this.
Well,
to
I'd
your
like
show,
to think
but just,
so.
There might be three or four. Yeah, who are still clinging on desperately to Radio 4. Where can we find your show, Julie?
Monday to Friday, 6:30 in the morning until 10 o'clock. Feel free to tune in anytime. You won't need a note from your mother if you're late. But we are on DAB, online, and on your Alexa speaker and all of that. But yeah, we're not on FM, so you might have to retune your little DAB radio to find us.
And I'm only on twice a month, so it's all right.
We should be on more.
Well, that's very kind of you.
I'm a very big fan.
Julie, thank you so much
you
for coming
and your
in.
Tash.
In case anybody is wondering, there have been a lot of mentions, aspersions cast about my appearance. I've grown a moustache. I know you can't see this. You might be able to hear it rustling along the microphone as I laugh, but that's what's
foraging
going on.
For fruit.
Well, I was led to believe that in the coming climate catastrophe, we're not actually going to warm up. There's going to be some sort of global ice age. And I thought, well, I can't really grow a beard, but I can keep my mouth warm so I can keep talking to you all, and that's what I enjoy doing the most. So
thank
I
you.
Thought that's what I'd do. It's
if
not
you want
sartorial.
To picture it, it's think Ron Jeremy becomes an extra on Narcos, possibly goes and does a TV show based in Hawaii. I mean,
you
just
say that
think...
like it's a bad thing. I would watch that show. That sounds phenomenal. And if anybody is thinking of pitching new shows to Netflix, I am completely down to play that character. Thank you so much. And you can also follow Julia on Twitter, which is just at JuliaHB1. And Andy and I never say no to a stalker, so if you're in need of some light entertainment, you can follow us as well, at AndyShaw1 and at Benedict Spence.